Hello everyone, welcome back to Morgan Hasn't Seen and the dark, grimy, gritty, slightly dystopian world of LA in 2019. 5 years ago, did it look like this? No, it didn't. And aren't we thankful for it? Because we have another pretty big movie on Morgan Hasn't Seen this week. As we said on the RoboCop episode, we are really cranking out my bucket list movies.
Yes, I'm on a mission.
From that. Oh, you are, yes, from that 250th episode special that we did do of Morgan Hasn't Seen, because we have another one in this series and another one this week. And as I remember saying on that special episode, and as has stayed true and has been true for quite a significant amount of time, I've always viewed this movie as the biggest movie that most people talked about, most people brought up to me and told me, I have to see this, I must see this. It is absolutely fundamentally required as any self-respecting movie fan. And that's, of course, what put me off watching the movie for a very long time, because I don't like that mentality.
Yeah.
I don't like that mentality. You know I don't like that mentality. People know I don't like that mentality. I like finding things for myself, and I don't mind being, you know, pushed in the right direction to watching certain things, but over and over and over again, to be told to watch Blade Runner gets a little bit annoying after a while and just makes you not want to watch it. But it's always been in my mind as such a massive movie that I had never seen. I'm very, very thankful that I now have seen it, and I'm very excited for this discussion. It wasn't like I'd never wanted to watch this movie. I was just being stubborn on all these people that had told
me. Telling you, you had to. Yes, yes. You need to do these things on your own time. Or on my time, which is now.
Or on your time. Yeah. That's why this show exists and has done for so long, you know.
Yes. You can't protest.
But it is a massive deal, this episode and this discussion today. My first time watching Blade Runner was only a few hours ago. Of the recording time.
Okay. So it's fresh in your mind.
It's very fresh.
Yes, we did actually have to do some research, especially after the whole Metropolis debacle that we went through on It's a Wonderful Podcast, to make sure.
I'd like to point out, I didn't go through a Metropolis debacle. I knew exactly what I was doing.
But I mean, a debacle in the fact that we did not discuss and make sure that we were both watching the same version of that movie. So,
yes,
you were entangled in the debacle in the aspect that we did not have a discussion and make sure we were mutually watching the same version. So we did go into this making sure we did some research and took some opinions on which version fans say is most likely the best version to watch, particularly for a first time watch. And most people agreed that the final cut that was released, I think, what, in like 2007, 2008, was the best version to watch. So that's what we did. That's what we'll be discussing, the final cut.
So. Yes, Blade Runner final cut, even though, you know, obviously the title of this episode will still say the year is 1982, because it's still, as far as I'm concerned, a movie from 1982. Just it was recut and re-released. And that's another reason, really, why I think it had taken me something like this to watch Blade Runner, because I never was quite sure which one to watch. There always seemed like there was about 9 different versions to watch.
Yes.
And everybody would argue over, oh, well, you should watch this one because of this, or this one because of this. The director's cut, the what's it called? The work print cut or something like that.
Yeah, there's like the work print cut. Then there's like the theatrically released cut. Then there's the international cut that's more violent. Then there's the director's cut that was approved by Ridley Scott, but not cut by Ridley Scott, and then the final cut that was cut by Ridley Scott. So those
which
earlier
is the one
versions,
we obviously found,
I think the work
was the most appropriate one to watch.
Yes, I think the work print version has like a different ending and different scenes cut out, and also has a really terrible lackluster voiceover from Harrison Ford, who was against the voiceover, so did not do a very good job with it.
But I feel like that sort of stuff and that sort of conversation can overwhelm somebody that hasn't watched Blade Runner before. When it is a movie that is so beloved like this, that has so many people so passionate about it, but also has that extra kind of knowledge layer of the different versions and what makes them all different and which one, you know, the arguments on which one is better than which and what is the true version of Blade Runner and all this kind of stuff, it overwhelms the inexperienced mind. Yeah. So me sitting outside of this, sitting back from this, hearing all this talk and all, you know, seeing all these articles, what, you know, seeing the videos, looking at various posts on wherever. I remember getting supplements in movie magazines about the Blade Runner, the greatest sci-fi movie ever. I think I've still owned this little kind of magazine supplement thing all about Blade Runner. I'm sure I've got a Blade Runner poster somewhere. And it's kind of been always in the background of my movie watching life, overwhelming me, putting pressure on me, but never allowing me to realize what the best way of going about watching it was. Before I would just, you know, put my hand up and say, no, I don't want all this argument. I'm tired of all this. I just, what is the movie? I don't need reasons. I just, what is the movie?
Yeah.
So I left that up to you, and you came back saying, okay, I've looked into some things. The final cut. So
yes.
that's what we watched. Yeah. That's the context of my life without Blade Runner, I suppose. And now my life has Blade Runner in it. And
well, is it better for it? Yes.
I would say so, because I think there's a reason that you thought, and I know you thought, I would really like Blade Runner anyway.
Yes. And
to an extent, I always thought I would like Blade Runner. It does seem, or it has always seemed, exactly the kind of very nasty mystery crime noir-y sci-fi that is right up my street. I'm sure you felt that I must have felt.
Yes, that. Yes. I definitely knew you were going to like the style of it, the story of it, this kind of futuristic noir, because I know how much you love noir. I think that's also why I chose the Armitage 3 for the beginning of this series, because that movie always felt very much influenced by Blade Runner. So I thought, you know, this would be a nice kind of nice preview movie for you going into Blade Runner. So I hope maybe it enhanced what you thought of Armitage a little bit after finally seeing Blade Runner. But yeah, I mean, everything in the style of this film, in the story of this film, was something I knew you were going to enjoy. So I'm really glad you finally was able to see it and we figured out kind of the best version to watch. So
yeah, I mean, do we want to go through the movie as we always do, or is this going to be more of a kind of questions you will throw at me format?
I mean, well,
given its size, given its popularity.
Yes. Well, just generally kind of the question I ask when we do these really popular films that have been a part of pop culture, have been out there in the world. How much did you know going into this? Like, were you aware of some of the biggest scenes,
right?
The introduction of the Rachel character, the Roy Batty tears in the rain speech, all of that kind of thing. So how much did you know? How much was familiar to you once you finally saw it? Again, did it did you have the context for some of those more popular scenes, or were you kind of just going off of the imagery of them in your head?
I definitely feel like I had more than enough context for even the more not controversial is the wrong word, the more symbolic scenes, okay, the more kind of theory inducing scenes, shall we say. I definitely have the context when those things came about in this movie, i.e. most notably, obviously, in this Deckard's unicorn dream and that sort of stuff, and the way, yeah, that is closed out and re-referenced at the very, very end of the movie, yes, into the Torigami form. Yes, I have the context to know that that birthed the theory of, is Deckard himself a replicant? I know, yes. I'm aware of all this. Why that was the case, obviously, I had no idea what it really meant. I had no idea, but the actual fact of it, or the idea of it, yes. So I get all that. I'm well aware of that whole theory, well aware that Deckard is himself a Blade Runner. Now, exactly what a Blade Runner was, I wasn't aware of. I didn't actually know a Blade Runner was essentially somebody who hunts down illegal replicants, because replicants are illegal on Earth because they have become too dangerous, too advanced as creations. They're really the most advanced out of all these cyborg robots, whatever we've talked about in the entire cyborg sci-fi series, aren't they? They are virtually human, and that's the most interesting thing, I think, really, about Blade Runner from an idea point, from a concept point, isn't it? And I know it obviously comes from the Philip K. Dick book, but that is really, I think, where the movie has developed such a passionate following from, is because it's clever enough to explore that idea of valuing life. I mean, it seems like the entire movie is really about the value of life and what life means to different people, and the fact that life seems to mean much more for those inhuman beings in this movie is a very, very interesting thing. And we see how far the replicants are willing to go
to get more life, because it's so precious to them. Their desire to have pictures and take pictures of their fleeting lives so they can have those memories, and then just
kind to of have real memories, not created memories.
A tangible image of something that they did, that's something that really happened for them, and not just an implanted memory that somebody gave them. And so then that just plays into the poetic line at the end of, memories and, the thing you do in your life just kind of fade away, like tears and rain. Like they don't, in the end, they don't really matter if you're not there to remember it, kind of thing. So, it's just this really weird juxtaposition of this inhuman thing kind of valuing that concept more than living people who tend to take it for granted. So it's kind of just this reminder of mortality and reminder of how life can be wasted by people who have it. So
and that was the really interesting kind of duality, I think, between Harrison Ford, between Deckard and Rutger Hauer as Roy Batty in the movie. There's such a real stark difference between the two of them. And if we just take it simply and try and view Deckard as the human he is presented as for potentially all of this movie, but at least 99% of this movie, depending on what you think about the actual unicorn situation. If you do actually just take it more simply and picture him as the human, he is he's just down and out. He's kind of miserable the entire movie. He's a perfect noir protagonist.
Yes,
he just likes sitting alone all the time, moping about, never really smiles.
Yeah, drinking. And you know, he's got his, you know, raincoat collar up.
Yeah,
and you know,
the only thing he's missing is a hat.
Yes, and I think that's maybe why they thought a voiceover would work, because it's giving off this kind of swanky noir vibe, but
absolutely
rainy and neon. Like, I think they felt like, okay, that will play into the noir aspects of this, but ultimately this movie didn't really need that. But I think I could get why, on, you know, first thought, oh, maybe a voiceover would work for this story. Like, I get, you know, thinking it.
Yeah, you know, genre-wise, playing with the genre.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would, because voiceover of your kind of down-and-out male protagonist in American noir movies is very, very prevalent. But there's more interesting things going on in Blade Runner than in a lot of those movies, and I mean that kind of layer-wise and symbolism-wise and this kind of stuff, where I do agree with the idea that any voiceover that Blade Runner would have diminishes the ambiguity surrounding its lead character.
Oh, yes, because, I mean, you've touched on that, and that was kind of something I was going to ask you. With what we get from the character, are you of the mind that he is a replicant? Because he believes the character is not. Like, he likes the idea of him being a human. Amongst kind of all these things going on. Whereas Ridley Scott, he, you know, in the back of his mind believes that he is in fact a replicant, but it was very intentional for them to leave it ambiguous. So
I think I almost want to answer this at the end of this episode, okay. And then maybe again at the end of next week's episode.
Okay.
When we're obviously talking about Blade Runner 2049 in that movie, that I am led to believe there's still ambiguity surrounding Deckard's actual reality in that movie as well. So, you know, there's no definitive answer. So I think we might get more of it then. We might not get more of it then. I really don't know what happens at all. Okay. I've got virtually no context for Blade Runner 2049, by the way. All my Blade Runner context comes from this movie. But the Tears in the Rain stuff, I'm obviously well versed in. I must have seen that scene countless times. Obviously not quite got the context impact that it does have when it comes about in that, you know, in that at the end of the climactic kind of battle. Mm-hmm. But it really struck me, watching it in context of the movie, just how miserable it is, actually, just how bleak of a monologue it is. Like, it sounds out of context beautiful and yes, very, very poignant. Poetic.
Yeah.
Poignant, yeah. But when you listen to that after watching everything that Roy Batty's gone through in the
entire and knowing movie, that he's saying it just moments before he knows he's going to die. Yeah.
Exactly. It is very, oh, well, memories don't really matter. None of it matters. We're dying. Everything just gets lost anyway. You'll be forgotten about. I'll be forgotten about. Time to die. And then dies. How miserable is that? How perfectly noir is that, by the way? Because we are living in miserable worlds there.
Yeah.
But, oh, my God, it really struck me as in its bleakness, in its morbidity, that I didn't ever get from just watching that scene out of context. And I think that can be so, so important. I remember we talked about, you know, this kind of thing happening with you for Gilda a few weeks ago when we did that on the main show.
Yeah.
And Gilda's famous entrance scene is something you're well aware of, but seeing it in context and seeing what happens around that whole scene, it puts a different spin on it, and it puts a more nuanced, you know, feeling towards it in your mind. And that's what the entire rest of the movie did for this obviously very famous scene at the end of this one.
Yeah.
For me, it gave it more significance in a different way than what I ever actually maybe thought it was. I just thought it was some outwardly over poetic dialogue. And sure it is. And there's times when Roy Batty in this movie does come out with slightly too poetic language and he's kind of just sauntering around thinking he's the best thing ever. And to an extent, I mean, he is. He's a creation that has become so, so human that he does kind of view himself as better than.
Yes. And craves and more life and craves a longer existence. Like, why wouldn't he want that if he didn't care about it so much? So it makes him a very interesting character and a kind of sympathetic villain in the fact that, you know, his motivation is
in a way
is to live life in the way that humans don't really allow themselves to.
Yeah. And his motivation, or his, you know, his group of mutinous replicants, as we'll call them. Who have, story-wise, I'd like to point out, by the way, I had no concept of what the actual specific story of Blade Runner was. No concept at all. So the whole mystery and the whole chasing down, you know, it being ultimately a police movie, a detective movie, I wasn't really aware that that was the case at all.
Yes.
Which I found very interesting. Obviously, it's a good mystery.
Yeah, and it very much feels noir, a kind of down and out retired cop essentially is pulled back into the game because he's the best at what he does and only he can do this job of wrangling this kind of ragtag crew of replicants who are causing all this trouble on Earth, and so they need him to come in and retire, is what they like to call getting rid of these replicants. So that's kind of generally the story, that he's pulled back out of kind of a retirement to investigate and find these replicants who are causing problems and killing people and retire them. So
I've forgotten what I was going to say now, I think, about Roy Batty and Rutger Hauer and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, he thinks himself better than everybody else. There he's the leader of the band of replicants that we see insist on. It's almost a thirst for knowledge that they have, a thirst for self-knowledge, almost, or knowledge of themselves. Who is my creator? Let's go and find my creator and ask my creator questions about myself in order to gain a more deeper understanding of my own being. That's their whole idea. And that isn't that such a human concept anyway? We're always
questioning life, our existence, who, what, where, when, why do we come from?
Precisely.
Yeah.
It's why people turn to religion. It's why religion exists. It's why all these grand...
What's your purpose?
Yeah, it's why all these grand concepts surrounding humanity actually exist. The fundamental question, what is the meaning of life, is very central to Blade Runner, which... Yeah. I wasn't really expecting any of this at all, which is what really fascinated me actually about it while watching it. Maybe I haven't been told enough about the more interesting parts of Blade Runner, and I'd just always been told, oh, it's such a great sci-fi movie, sci-fi Harrison Ford. It's like, yeah, okay, sci-fi Harrison Ford. I can go and watch Star Wars. I can go and watch some other movie. You know, I, that's not the most interesting part. The fact that this is a sci-fi movie that looks wonderful is a great part of this movie, because I think it is visually incredible. It's also, again, I mean, my mind is bouncing with all these ideas, by the way, at the moment. You can tell I actually did really, really enjoy this movie, because my mind is becoming rather frantic. But... the movie is also delightfully noir, given fact. From even beyond the ones we've already discussed, simply because there's no daytime, it's always night and it's always raining.
Yes, and there's so much neon, there's high skyscrapers and buildings, the flying cars, like I think every film that we've discussed in this sci-fi series have all put great care into creating these really interesting, vast, dynamic looking worlds. And this film definitely speaks to that as well. Yes. You know, it's grimy. You feel, you know, that this place is lived in. You get such a very specific mood from this place. And the fact that it is based on a real place that we know in a time that's now past is just also an interesting thing to kind of think about as well. The fact that, like, this is a place that is known for constant sunny skies, but in this version of it, it's always raining. So just it's to always kind of
dark. I've never seen so much dark misery in LA in my entire life. It's a place I know very well. It's a place we have been together quite a lot of the time.
So the fact that it challenges your mind in that way, I think, is also really interesting. You know, your car can just be parked and you have these like little people just stealing things from you as you're going about your day. It feels very much like an interesting lived in version of a place that we know that is kind of just challenged by how it looks and how its future exists. And it's just really cool to look at as well. So,
I mean, I do remember when I was in LA last year, actually going into the Bradbury building in downtown LA, where the start of the climax of the movie is, when, you know, Harrison Ford's walking up those industrial looking stairs and it's all, you know, full of iron and everything like that. It's a very industrial looking movie, by the way. There's so much steam and metal everywhere. It's great like that. I do really like this aesthetic, and I think it's why, for some reason, I'm remembering when we covered The Fifth Element and everything was clean and bright, and I didn't love that.
It was this like very much lush, bright version of kind of what this movie did.
This RoboCop Armitage 3. This is the dirty side of sci-fi. This is the nasty side of sci-fi. This is what I like. I like it to still feel tangible. I like it to still feel lived in. And there's just rubbish everywhere, you know, trash everywhere.
A little bit grimy, especially if you're calling it, or, you know, being inspired by a noir, you want it to feel a little dirty, a little grimy.
There's broken buildings everywhere. You know, like, it doesn't look like any windows actually have glass in them in this movie. It's that kind of horrible, horrible feeling. But also this massive scale, you know, lights, dials, digital kind of retro
screens, advertisements.
Massive ideas, massive visual ideas. That really just make it feel very scaled up when it needs to, but not on the same level of, say, the movies we've spoke about this month on the main show, or Metropolis or Forbidden Planet, that feel scale, you know, that are scaled in a truly enormous sense, to the point where you get human stories within them, but I think something like Blade Runner is far more interested in being focused on the intricacies of things going on, focused on the little thing going on within this enormous world, because we don't get too much, get the odd exposition shot, that's not what you call it, but I don't think that's what you call it, but my mind's gone blank now, of the scale of dystopian 2019 LA. But everything really, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter really, because what matters is why Deckard has been pulled back into being a Blade Runner again by recently passed away M. Emmett Walsh. So RIP to him, because he's recently passed away. credit there. He pulls him back into his old job. I also don't think my mind today is flirting around like craziness. You can really tell.
No, you're really excited about this. Job.
it has done the job, this movie. It really did. Harrison Ford's scar, I don't think, has ever been photographed quite as well as it was in this movie.
Yeah, it was really
prominent. Like, there was a sheen to it. There was a shimmer to it. It was noticeable. It reminded me again of Gilda and George MacReady's face scar that's always on the show. And there's just something that brings out a little bit of, I don't know, danger within that character.
Yeah.
And I know it's a natural thing of Harrison Ford's face. He's had it since he was a child. This, you know, his kind scar of under scar his happened.
Lip, yeah.
But they seem to focus on it, or they seem to like light it in such a way that, and I know Ridley Scott's obviously a very, very visual director.
Well, yeah, like even like the little tricks he had to employ to kind of get that glint in a replicant's eyes. Like he had to do this kind of interesting mirror effect on the camera in order to get that glint, because obviously the technology didn't exist in the at the time to do that. So, yeah, I mean, he's very much tries to find a way to light things in certain ways, to shoot things in certain ways, to maybe focus thing on things that you maybe wouldn't think about. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was an intentional thing to highlight that, to kind of play into who this character is. Like you said, make him feel more dangerous. I mean, we see the scene of him after he's kind of, you know, we see him get his ass beat quite a bit by these replicants.
Dude.
And a scene where he's fighting one of them and Rachel saves him. And this is after he's kind of revealed to her that she is a replicant, because she was kind of set up to be a replicant who was not told that she was a replicant. So she had no idea. So he goes to like the Tyrell Corporation. He meets the guy and he does the test on Rachel to kind of see how long she can last and kind of test if the test actually works. So he forms his relationship with her. She ends up saving him from a replicant, one of the replicant crew that's about to kill him. And
yeah, that dude with no chin.
Yeah. We've seen him
in many movies.
Yes. And we do see him. He's getting that test at the beginning of this film. After he's kind of had this big fight with him, we see him drinking some alcohol out of a cup. And we just see all of this blood spill back into the cup after he takes a sip. So we, you know, it's this really great visual of just how kind of broken down and beaten he is. But because we're kind of focusing on these kind of rough details on his face, we, you know, get the sense that, you know, this is normal for him. He can handle this. So the fact that all this blood is coming out into his drink from his mouth and he's not even fazed by it. Also just a visual detail that plays into just how tough this guy is. So I like, you know, that you brought up the scar and it just, you know, pointed me back to other kind of visual things they did with the character to just kind of solidify that he is kind of the right man for this job and why, you know, he would be employed to handle this, because, you know, we're given enough just through visuals that he can. So
yeah, there's so much attention to detail in every little shot in Blade Runner, and I really like that about it. That is a very Ridley Scott thing.
Yeah.
Because he is a real hound for detail in every little shot. He loves seeing what's happening more than anything else while making a movie. And I think it's probably what makes Alien so good as well, if you're talking about Ridley Scott's sci-fi output of this sort of 5-year period that we're in. With Blade Runner, obviously a few years before, it was Alien. And you look at the visual aesthetic of Alien, it's very, very attention to detail. There's so many little, tiny little light things going on. And the design of it all, it is really the most important part of that movie. And arguably the most important part of this movie is crafting the world itself that makes all the philosophical pontificating of Roy Batty actually hold some weight because it feels real and it feels like this is a genuine place with genuine real people and everybody's trying to make sense of it. Because if it didn't have that real lived in, real tangible quality to it, that wouldn't be anywhere near as effective.
Yeah. And I think also something really interesting from one of the videos that I watched in my kind of research and trying to find the best version to watch. I don't want to take credit for this thought, that someone kind of pointed out how the replicants are killed by Deckard is very much like they're the hero. Like, we're meant to sympathize with them, like shooting them and showing them falling in this traumatic way in slow motion. Like, they're almost the ones under assault and being attacked. And so it really has you kind of question, you know, the morality in trying to destroy these things who value life so much.
Very much so, which is way more kind of hyped up when you think of the leader of them is Rutger Hauer, a famously menacing actor
who
is full of menace in this movie as well. He is kind of terrifying, steely blue eyes and all the great things that we love about Rutger Hauer's intense, enigmatic performances. Yet, you are right. The replicants are the more sympathetic ones in this movie. Why are they really being judged for escaping from their slave
labor
life?
Yeah.
On these outer world colonies that they have, but we never see. We're just told that, you know, the people of Earth have gone and spread out to different planets and created
and they've used to help
as slaves.
Explore. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why would we not want to see slave revolt? You know.
Yeah.
This seems like a good thing. I am Spartacus, say all the replicants.
Yes.
That's what we should be doing.
Yes, and I mean, also plays into kind of the themes we saw in Armitage 3 with, you know, why do you create us and then hate us, you know?
Exactly.
You kind of use
when you think about it like that, it's weird.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, why do you make something mad that you're ultimately going to hate and then you try to destroy us kind of mentality? So it's these really interesting juxtaposition of ideas and ideologies going into this film for sure.
Especially when me for so long has been told Roy Batty is one of the great sci-fi villains. He's not the villain of this movie. He's not. There's no villain in this movie. It's what a great noir does. Doesn't really have a villain.
He's just kind of going off of the understanding he has, you know, of the world and what he's seen and, you know, trying to reconcile what he was created for to these wants that he just finds himself having. So he's kind of just a victim of his programming and the development of what was put into his head, really.
Can we really be mad with him when he is an artificial creation?
Yeah.
You know, no, but also he does very violently kill his own creator.
Yeah.
Very, very violently. I wasn't quite expecting such striking thumb in the eye violence.
Yeah.
And the thumb in the eye as well. I think, what other movie is it that has a great, I think it's 28 Days Later. Cillian Murphy thumbs somebody in the eyes that movie. It's awful. It's one of the most horrendous things. I mean, I can stomach most things in movies like this, most gore type things in movies, but thumb in the eyes is a serious, serious, nasty one.
Yeah. And
Roy Batty delivers his creator, the leader of the Tyrell Corporation. Not that Tyrell, not the ones from Game of Thrones.
Yes.
That would be strange, wouldn't it? Imagine if it was Diana Rigg who showed up.
Oh, my gosh.
Lady Diana Rigg, and she was there. being the leader of the Tyrell Corporation.
I mean, she could, but I mean, behind his casting as well, I think Ridley Scott had seen him. He was kind of off watching scenes of him playing the bartender in The Shining and said immediately that he wanted to cast him as the head of the Tyrell Corporation.
He's creepy as that bartender in The Shining anyway. Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's an interesting character because he is quite, you know, he's very full of himself, very aloof, very, what are you going to do? I am the father of this entire civilization. You can't do anything with me. And, you know, we actually can. You've created something that has developed beyond your understanding of us. And let's laugh in your face, ask you questions about give me more life because I want more life. And the replicants do enjoy life. I think we see the replicants genuinely enjoy existing. You have Daryl Hannah as one of them.
Yeah.
Who seems to really doesn't have a lot going for her in life, but enjoys just being there and meeting people and running around and dressing up and doing all these kind of things.
Oh, yeah, and doing her little gymnastics. Like, she's having a blast.
Yeah. You know, they have more smiles on their faces. And, I mean, not many smiles go on many people's faces in Blade Runner. It is it's rainy by nature and rainy by name, and that doesn't make sense, but you know what I mean?
Yes, and I mean, rainy. And part of the test, the Voight-Kampff test for the replicants, is to reveal kind of their unfeeling nature. So the line of questioning leads into that. So definitely we're not getting too many smiles from the replicants because they're made to be kind of this cold, unfeeling entity. So part of that test is meant to reveal that. So definitely another piece that's not giving us kind of a smiley demeanor at all.
No, but it's when they get the freedom that I think we see a certain light enter them. And obviously, particularly with Rutger Hauer, because he does just become quite strutting around going, oh, this is, I could get used to this. This is really quite enjoyable. I want more of it. And then when he obviously learns he can't get more of it.
Yeah, because they're kind of set up. Yeah, because they're set up with this kind of four-year lifespan. And they're just shut down at a certain point. And so he feels the shutdown imminent for him. And so that's when they do go seek out their father, essentially, to ask him for more lives. And when he cannot deliver,
But it's almost a mystery for them, because, or a discovery for them, an investigation for them into finding their creator, finding, you know, Mr. Tyrell. And, you know, mirror that with Deckard's investigation and mystery of what are these replicants doing here? Who are, obviously, first and foremost, who are the replicants? Because you can't tell them apart from humans without this ridiculously laborious test that you have to do. Which I can imagine if you try doing that time and time and time again to the wrong people, it just becomes ridiculous. You never get anywhere. So you have to be very, very good at your job as a Blade Runner. And of course, Deckard was and is still, you know, over the course of this movie, good at his job as a Blade Runner.
But then, of course, you know, we have our femme fatale coming in and distracting in the way that they do. So,
fatale, I think. Fatale might be a little... Oh, she is distracting.
Well, the stand-in for that archetype in a noir. So maybe not essentially fitting all the typical attributes, but, you know, the stand-in for that figure.
She is, Rachel, again, I mean, I feel like I've said this with everybody, but she is possibly the most interesting character in the whole movie. Maybe I'm saying that because out of everything about this movie, I knew virtually nothing about Rachel.
Really?
Going in. For some reason, nobody had ever mentioned Sean Young as Rachel. Don't know why.
No, she's a very kind of those images of her, like her introduction, walking in, her sitting smoking, the glow in her eyes while she's taking the test. All of those have been kind of put up as iconic images from this film. So,
yeah, for some reason, they must have evaded me.
Her with that hairstyle, very specific, you know, the lips.
It's a great hairstyle.
Yeah.
It's a great hairstyle. I love everything about her whole character, her performance in this movie. I think she's absolutely wonderful. The fact you have her as a replicant who doesn't know she's a replicant, I didn't even know that concept was going to be in this movie. I thought all the replicants knew they were replicants, and okay, they might have been, you know, some sort of issue with the humans and what have you, and that's why there was this kind of back and forth, that's why Harrison Ford got involved, whatever. I had no idea we were going to have this kind of third idea.
Yeah, I mean, she's this experimental version of them where he thought, okay, well, what if we don't tell them that she is? Can she, you know, be more human in that aspect? And he proves that she can be, because she outlasts the test longer than any other replicant. Because she
like three has, times longer.
Yes, because she has these human memories and that have been implanted in her head, and so she has an image of a mother and a childhood and all of this. So she has no clue, and that plays into her feeling more human, acting more human. And so when Decker tells her she's not, and she comes to that realization, like she's crying about it. But you know, because she ends up feeling so human and ultimately saving him in the moment that she saves him, you know, he becomes endeared to her and falls in love with her, despite her kind of being the thing that he's meant to capture and kill. So
now, is that another indication as to Deckard's potential replicantness? Because do humans, I mean, we don't know anything about the romantic side of any of this. Do humans fall in love with replicants? Do replicants fall in love with humans? Do
yes, and so
really feel that, love to humans? You know, is there that kind of cross?
Yeah, I mean, so they juxtapose so many different interesting things that have you kind of confused on how this works. Because is he falling in love with her because of how she was programmed, because of how she was implanted with these memories? Is he falling in love with her because she feels so human, more human than a normal replicant because of how she was programmed? Does it prove that he's human and she's a replicant because he's able to kind of give her orders to kiss him, to say that she trusts him, to say that she loves him, and she obeys his orders as that dynamic of a human to a replicant slave robot kind of thing?
Or obviously, is it the replicant, potential replicant, falling in love with the other replicant? Again, given the fact that...
Yes, is he endeared to her because they are one and the same?
Yeah, Deckard is clearly, if he is a replicant, a far more advanced replicant than even Rachel.
Yeah.
So there might be that next stage of experimentation that nobody's just telling Deckard. This is all unspoken and all theoretical and all hypothetical. Yeah. But it brings the questions up, these little
indications. And we have a shining example of a replicant who doesn't know that they're a replicant in Rachel.
Yeah.
So how do we know that there's not another replicant who doesn't know they're a replicant in Deckard?
Totally. So, unreliable narrator.
Yes. And so, you know, now, you know, that I think about it, I mean, she can be considered a bit of a femme fatale in the fact that, like, you know, you could see that storyline in a noir where your detective falls in love with the woman he's supposed to target, he's supposed to kill, who's on his kill list, because his boss even tells him she's on the list of people that you need to capture and retire because she's gone missing from the Tyrell Corporation. But because she helped save him, he just can't find it in him to hurt her or kill her, even though she is one of the things that he's meant to kill. So very much a noir storyline, for sure, with Rachel and him.
It really is. And do you know what? I couldn't tell you why this exact movie popped into my head. Pushover from 1954 with Fred McMurray. And Kim Novak, I think it's Kim Novak's first movie. Kim Novak is the girlfriend of the criminal leader who Fred McMurray is supposed to be staking out and arresting. And guess who falls in love with who? They both fall in love with each other. And she ends up helping him over her own actual boyfriend.
Yeah, so that seems very common. So I think Rachel definitely is a great foil for that archetype in a noir film. And the fact that they're doing it, but with this futuristic spin in terms of the setting of this movie and the plot points,
yeah,
I think is really interesting, for sure. And so I did like their dynamic, and I like that their relationship just adds, kind of piles on to the questions of what in fact is Deckard.
It does. You know, and that, you know, that means we end the movie with him picking up that little origami unicorn that he gets from Edward James Olmos, who we haven't mentioned in the movie yet, who is a bizarre character in this movie, I'd like to point out.
Yes.
Kind of comes in, makes origami, screams a bit, and then leaves for significant chunks of the movie. But he picks that up and they leave their apartment building together. The credits roll then. They leave together. We don't know what happens next. Well, we will know next week when we watch Blade Runner 2049. You already know what happens to Deckard next. I have no concept at all.
Well, I've only seen it once.
Gosling's in it as well.
Yes. And Ana de Armas. I've only seen it once, so I definitely do need a refresher on kind of what happened. So I'll be feeling like a bit of a first time watch with you, because I don't quite remember what happened. But and I like that they end it there, and I do think in other subsequent versions we do see them like driving down the road together to you know, so we see kind of them going off somewhere with him doing that voiceover again. So you know, if you did want some kind of weird version that gives you more detail on where they're headed or what they're doing, then I guess you could watch those other versions, but I don't think we really need that here. I think this works really well.
Yeah, and I mean, the movie thrives on its mystery surrounding exactly who its characters are. So I think that the less you get about specifics and inner monologues and that kind of stuff, the better, or the better the movie works, because it keeps you thinking.
Yeah,
it keeps that mystery alive. We end this movie with more questions than we began this movie, which might not sound like a great thing, but after having watched it, is such a great thing.
Yeah.
Because it all furthers the, I suppose, experience of consuming this story that we just have over 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, leaving you with that potential that Edward James Olmos may have known about Deckard's unicorn dream that we see. Why it has to be a unicorn, God knows why it has to be a unicorn. God knows what relevance the unicorn has.
I mean, just a fictional thing that he's... I mean, just a fictional thing that he wouldn't have seen in life, so that it wouldn't feel like a memory. Just to establish it as not something that could be a memory from life that he's dreaming about or daydreaming about.
Well, that's right.
So it could be something implanted in his mind because it's something he's never seen before, something that doesn't exist, that he can't just write off as me misremembering something.
See, maybe this is just me having been constantly, you know, told and been made aware of the unicorn dream, and I've always viewed it as a dream. So it's a dream, and, you know, God, we're not getting into dream interpretation now. That takes us down a ridiculous
Well, some versions, rationale. Some other versions don't even have this piece in there. So,
But it
was intentional for Ridley to add it back in. Ridley, who on his end does believe Deckard to be a replicant. So we have come to the conclusion near of this episode. So I think, you know, is this the proper time to circle back on the question? Do you
I think so, and it's what I was trying to re-bring back up by bringing this up anyway. Because it isn't. My mind is leaning towards yes, okay. And my mind is maybe it does have something to do with actually exactly what you've just said, given that it may. The whole unicorn situation may be an implanted memory of, I mean, sure, many people will have memories of horses running through fields and forests.
But for someone else to specifically know that that is something that's in your head to make that little origami thing of, you know.
Yeah, but that's one layer of it, and the other layer of it being that it's a unicorn, a mythical creature, not actually something that is real. Because if it was a horse, then you know, you're not thinking as definitively about it as you are. But the fact it is a unicorn, it's a good point. It's something I hadn't actually thought about. I didn't really realize why it was a unicorn. It seemed to me to not matter what it was.
Just be a random choice. Yeah, no, it's something that doesn't exist, so it can't be confused with an actual memory. You know, I do really like the idea that Harrison Ford has for the character, that he likes the idea of him being human and capable of that type of growth, that he can have this hate for, you know, and this really resolute attitude towards these replicants and having it be easy for him to kill them without any kind of remorse for, you know, them as almost like creatures who are just kind of helpless in their existence. But him having that growth through Rachel in finding some compassion and understanding for this perspective that they have this belief in, for being these things that are created and then hated, and them feeling that somehow, and them being these creatures that value life far more than he does his own. Harrison Ford really appreciates the idea of a human man being able to have that character growth and kind of learn from that in a way and take that in. So that's why Harrison Ford wants to believe that Deckard is human. So
let's not forget also, right before Roy Batty died and gave his whole you know, famous monologue,
Tears
speech
of Rain,
that he likes to give, he saves Deckard's life. He pulls him back up from falling off the building.
Yeah.
And sits him there. At that point, Roy values Deckard's life. Maybe just to spurt some ideas into his mind before Roy dies, sure. But that's another interesting little thing we've got to think about there, and maybe gives Deckard as human more things to think about in terms of his own relationship towards replicants. Does he now become more, I don't know. To use the word friendly isn't a movie that this word should be in tandem with, but I'm going to use the word friendly with replicants. Does he become more friendly with replicants after these experiences of this movie? If he is a human, yes, I think he does. As you've just said, Harrison Ford likes to believe that would be the case.
Yeah.
But as Ridley Scott points out, as the whole unicorn situation points out, is he actually a replicant? How does Edward James Olmos know that he might have thought about a unicorn? Is it a pure coincidence? Yeah. Nothing's really ever a pure coincidence, is it?
Yeah.
Why would he have made an origami unicorn? It's a very specific thing to make.
Yeah.
Given what we saw halfway through the movie with the dream / memory. So, is he? It's a tough question. I think it's quite an unanswerable question. I think I prefer the reading that he is.
Okay.
But the fact that I would perfectly happily watch this movie again, knowing the idea of him being a replicant, knowing all the context behind the idea of him being a replicant and knowing exactly how that plays out in the movie, I would happily watch this movie again with me constantly telling myself, Deckard's a human. Deckard's a human. He's a human. And I've just got to keep reminding myself that he's a human. And I think you would see that reading
okay
much clearer.
Yeah.
Which isn't that the best thing about these kind of movies anyway? The fact it's actually wants you, it actively wants you to watch it again, and then watch it a third time.
Yeah. Oh, I like that.
It's great. It's great. Why? Why hadn't I watched Blade Runner before? We know why. I spent 10 minutes at the beginning telling everybody why I hadn't watched Blade Runner before. Was I aware that I was going to enjoy Blade Runner this much? Probably. Probably, to be honest. Okay. It's everything I like in grimy, grungy sci-fi.
And noir.
And noir and mystery and all these kind of nasty things. It's speaks to my fondness and tendencies within movies.
Yes.
It really, really does. Am I thankful I can now shove it in everybody's face that I have seen Blade Runner shut up telling me to watch Blade Runner? Yes. And am I going to ever tell anybody else to watch Blade Runner? No. I'm not. Because I know how much it's hurt me.
Because everyone else has already seen it.
Because everyone else has already seen it, sure, yeah. I mean, children, Janine. I mean, children haven't seen Blade Runner.
Okay.
You know, when children get age appropriate enough to watch Blade Runner, then I won't be the one telling them to. I mean, maybe just push them into the general genre direction.
Okay.
Rather than there. They'll find it for themselves. But I know how much it hurt me because I should have watched this movie 10 years ago, at least.
Yes, probably.
You know?
Yes.
I feel fulfilled now having watched it. Do I regret not seeing it before? Probably.
Okay, that's fair.
But do I regret my own stubbornness and sticking to my guns? No, never.
Of course not. Of course not. Dying never, ever. Hell, as per usual. Well, yay. Another bucket list film checked off the list. I think, have you enjoyed everything on the bucket list thus far?
What have we checked off the bucket list so far? RoboCop, obviously, which was last episode. Yes, I did. What else have we done on the bucket list? I forget.
Ghost,
that was good. Yes, I like Ghost. There's been others. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Terrible. I can't remember. 13 going on 30. That was fun.
Yes.
Yes, I liked that. The lobster, that was very good. Yes, they've all been good.
Yay.
They've all been very enjoyable in their own ways.
Yes.
You know, definitely I think the lobster is a little bit less fun. Maybe it's kind of fun at times, I suppose,
yeah,
the lobster.
A little silly, a little interesting, quirky. Quirky.
Not quite the same as 13 going on 30, though.
No, very different.
A notable
but I found silly. A way. I found a way to fit that into a series together.
You did. Yes. You really did. It's very good. It's very good. But Blade Runner, the final cut specifically, all the applause has to go to it, I really do think. Up there with the very best of Harrison Ford, up there with my very favourite of Harrison Ford. I feel like we've, in recent Morgan Hasn't Seen, done a couple of heavy hitter Harrison Ford movies in this and The Fugitive, which I don't feel like was that long ago. When did we do The Fugitive?
Last year? Last, like, maybe September, maybe, when we were doing
it. No, it wasn't that long ago. Surely
Are
not.
You sure?
Was it that long ago? Has time gone that quickly?
I don't know. We did an action. Didn't we just do an action movie series?
I have no idea.
It was in the action movie series where we did Thelma and Louise. And I think that was,
Was it that long ago?
I feel like that was like end of last year.
Oh, I know why. It's because I watched half of The Fugitive over Christmas. That's why I'm remembering it wrong, because I've watched a bit of The Fugitive
since
then.
I feel like we did it like the beginning stages of the end, last part of the year. So like September, we wouldn't have done in October. We wouldn't have done in December. So it was either September or November, I would say, that we did it. action movies.
That's bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's bad. What is time? I don't know.
I don't remember when we did it, but yes.
Anyway, Blade Runner is the penultimate episode of this cyborg sci-fi series. Blade Runner 2049 is coming next week. We're sticking with the character. We're sticking with the world. We're just 30 years ahead now. We actually don't know what 2049 will look like in LA, but we do know what 2019 looked like, and it thankfully wasn't this.
It was bleak, pretty bleak. Yeah,
it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows, but it wasn't as horrible.
No.
As the Blade Runner world. No, definitely not. But of course, this is not the only show we have on the It's a Wonderful Podcast feed, is it, Janine? Because we have It's a Wonderful Podcast, the main show where we celebrate old movies every single week. Cyborgs, robots, sci-fi movies have also taken over there as well. And this coming Friday, we're going to be talking about Westworld with Yul Brynner and James Brolin, Richard Benjamin, and Mike Michael Crichton. Obviously loves his theme parks going wrong, and it's pretty fun, robot-y craziness in Westworld. So that's what's coming on the main show this coming Friday. And last week was Forbidden Planet. We've already mentioned that.
Yeah.
And Metropolis as well, that we've covered over there. Go and check them out if you haven't already. And subscribe, of course, to this podcast feed wherever you get your podcast, on all major podcast platforms. Subscribe, ding your notification bell over on the It's a Wonderful Podcast YouTube channel as well. And of course, if you would like to support us on Patreon or donate in any such way, there are links in the description of this episode to go and do that. We would give you the biggest of heart hands forever and always. We would show you love like no love is shown in Blade Runner at all for anybody ever, because it's a miserable movie. apart from the love story that is in there.
Yes.
That does make sense and does motivate the movie in a certain acceptable direction. That's a way too negative word to mention it. No, in a lovely direction.
We would love you like Rachel loves Decker. Okay.
Exactly.
That's basically what you're trying to say. Okay.
It is. you can, of course, also find us on social media though. At It's a Wonderful One on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter at the Purple Don with A3 instead of the E and the, because Janine.
3 is the magic number.
On Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at the Purple Don. All your replicant stuff is where.
You can find me at @JanineDeBean_ on Twitter, @JanineDeBean on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. If you want to get any merch for any of our shows, just check the description for the link or search It's a Wonderful Podcast on teespring.com. And if you want to purchase any of my art in print form, you can find that at my Big Cartel shop, g9design.bigcartel.com.
Do you know the Tears in the Rain monologue?
I do not.
No, that's a shame. That was my plan this whole time to get you to.
Well, you should have told me that. I would have prepared it. I mean, you just freshly watched it. I watched this like last
night. I know it's something like I have seen starships beyond Orion and seen something or other in some sort of cattle. I don't know. There's nothing to do with cattle.
Let me see. Okay. I have it here.
All these. Okay. You've got it. Failure averted.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire up the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears in rain.
Lovely stuff. There we go. Bye.
Bye.